This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM, by mobile app, and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is James Osman. James is an anthropologist specializing in Khoisan Bushman peoples of Southern Africa and has lived and worked with every major Bushman group. He was awarded a Smuts Commonwealth Fellowship in African Studies at Cambridge University and led the De Beers Group's award-winning sustainability and public affairs initiatives. Recently, he founded Anthropos, a think tank that applies anthropological methods to solving contemporary social and economic problems. James Osman is here to tell us about his book, Affluence Without Abundance, The Disappearing World of the Bushman, published in 2017. Welcome, James.
Thank you very much.
What is your purpose in writing Affluence Without Abundance?
I suppose I had two thoughts when I started writing the book. The first one was really to write a good book about Bushmen, the people that live in Southern Africa, Southern Africa's first people, the indigenous people, because so much has been written about them in the popular press. And so often it's reductive and overly romantic, and it really sort of builds on a massive myth. So that was the first thought. I've been there so long, and I've been working on it for such a long time, that I really just wanted to convey something that honestly represented what life for them was like. But as I started writing the book, it became clear to me that there were certain kind of big ideas swimming around beneath the surface in that that needed to come out. And more that began to shape the book. And these big ideas were to do with questions about how we think about affluence, wealth, success, how we imagine our futures in the world, and likewise, questions about sustainability. And these came about largely because of one big question that I suppose has been asked about hunter-gatherers for years and years, and that is whether their lives were somehow more sustainable than ours, or whether, as most people popularly believe, they lived lives of this kind of enduring and difficult misery.
In your book, you focus on Bushmen of the Kalahari. Why did you choose this group?
I suppose it was a matter of me choosing them as much as them choosing me. I mean, when I was an undergraduate in Scotland, anthropology offered us the opportunity to actually take a semester off and go somewhere interesting. You know, we were allowed to go kind of anywhere. And frankly, I just wanted to go somewhere warm. And the Kalahari Desert kind of sprung into my mind, and I'd always been wanting to go and see that part of the world. And I'd always been wanting to hang out with Bushman peoples. And once I was there, I was hooked. And really, that was the rest of my life sort of set down, or at least the next 25 years of my life, nailed as I got sucked deeper and deeper into the Kalahari. And of course, the places like that, the difficult thing is you realize that after each period of time that you're there, and if, you know, as this goes on for years and years and years and years, you become more aware of the fact that actually you're just beginning to learn to ask the right questions, let alone find the kinds of answers that you're thinking about.
In your book, you point out that traditional hunter-gatherers were egalitarian societies. What social forces contributed to the hunter-gatherers being egalitarian?
I think the whole idea of egalitarian is the really interesting thing. You know, we live in a society at the moment where people tend to imagine that somehow naturally we're hierarchical creatures, that naturally we have these tremendous differentials in wealth, that naturally we have these tremendous differentials in power, and we see it reiterated again and again and again in all sorts of different shapes or form. And it's a major thing in particular, far more explicitly in U.S. politics than, say, for example, European politics. And this idea that we're naturally hierarchical, naturally ambitious, naturally seeking power is contested by the fact that hunter-gatherers almost universally are egalitarian. And the important thing to remember with that is that, you know, as I suppose the science has got better, we've begun to realize that we were hunters and gatherers in quite a sophisticated way for a much longer period of time than was ever imagined. You know, we now think that really for at least 150,000 years, modern Homo sapiens were hunting and gathering before. Really, in that last, I suppose, blink of an eye, the last 10,000 years, we started farming and doing all those other things. And if it's the case that during in hunter-gatherer societies that we were highly egalitarian, then it suggests actually that there's something much more egalitarian from an evolutionary point of view than we tend to imagine. So that when we ascribe this idea that it's somehow natural to be hierarchical, that doesn't really stand up particularly well to the evidence of history. And when looking at this question of egalitarianism, I mean, it sort of raises this big issue of, you know, we're instinctively selfish and we instinctively try and get something over in the other. And it's a question of how in these societies does one try and reconcile, I suppose, our social instincts and our selfish instincts. And certainly when you look at societies like the Bushmen, I mean, what happens is that actually things like selfish instincts, because life is lived so publicly and because cooperation is so important, selfish instincts tend to be sort of closely expressed. But the sum of those selfish instincts in a society like that tends to be this very strong and fiercely egalitarian culture. So interestingly, there's no clash between being selfish and egalitarian. But what they have is that form of egalitarianism. And I believe, certainly on the basis of evidence, that that was actually crucial to helping human beings, early Homo sapiens, develop the kind of complex social forms that ultimately aided our incredible evolutionary success. If we hadn't been egalitarians, I do not think that humans would have been as successful as they were, and we may well not be sitting in a radio studio here in Seattle in the way we are now, because probably if we're so deeply hierarchical and too busy stealing food from each other's mouths, we'd probably still be doing that.
In your book, you mention the common tradition of insulting the meat and how that helped keep the society egalitarian. Would you say a bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. What happened in Bushmen cultures, in particular the Zhengwasi, the people that I work most closely with, is they had various mechanisms aimed at keeping this egalitarian basis together. And this is, of course, a society without leaders and without judicial institutions and without laws. You know, and you ask, how do you maintain this egalitarianism when people have these kind of instincts? It was best exemplified in this tradition of insulting the meat. What happened was when a hunter went off and killed a large animal, perhaps a giraffe or an eland, something which would feed lots of people for a very long time, and meat was the most prized of all foods by miles. But when a hunter came back to the compound to say that they'd killed something and they'd like some help in bringing that meat back, instead of being praised, which would be very much what we'd expect, certainly in this kind of Western model, hooray, you've done a tremendous job, instead he'd be insulted. And he'd be insulted continuously. Ah, people would say, even if it was a magnificent giraffe, they'd say, ah, this is a scrawny giraffe, it's a terrible looking thing, not even enough to feed my mother-in-law. And the insults would be rolled out even as people were filling their stomachs. And these kind of insults were played out to actually pretty much anybody who had a windfall, if they found tons of food or if they were given something amazing, or if they started getting too big for their boots. And the reason they did this, as Zhengwasi said, is they did it to cool people's hearts. And they cooled people's hearts because it was a way of sort of stopping any kind of hierarchies when they formed, and in particular with hunting and insulting the meat. The idea was that actually in an egalitarian society like this, if somebody hunts too well and hunts too often, then what would happen is they might begin to sort of subtly accumulate power through their ability to distribute this really important resource. It's a hunter's right to share the meat out. And in a sense, that's a way of gathering power. So in a sense, this was done almost to discourage people from basically gathering too much resources or seeking too much power. It was meant to make it not worth the trouble. And of course, this has a flip side now, in that with people like the Zhengwasi San, who I work with, and many of the other San groups, they're now hugely marginalized. And they're minorities in modern, fast-growing African nation states. And the problem is this tradition of insulting the meat means that within those communities who need leadership and representation, there's a great reluctance to do so because their constituencies, the other Zhengwasi, will generally insult anybody. Instinctively, they'll respond very negatively towards anybody who tries to put themselves in a leadership position or gain power in that sort of way.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is James Sussman, author of the book Affluence Without Abundance, The Disappearing World of the Bushmen. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP, 90.3 FM by mobile app, and on the web at kexp.org. What was the attitude of traditional hunter-gatherers toward work?
Well, it's a very interesting question, and I suppose there are two big ways of looking at it. The first one is to really ask ourselves, how much work did they do? Now, the perception in the sort of, I suppose, long ago, was that hunter-gatherers lived this kind of life of unremitting struggle. The sort of, you know, we see it shown in movies and things from the Croods all the time, this idea that some of them being either it's eat or be eaten, and they were constantly on the run, constantly fighting starvation. Now, the first serious studies of how hard hunter-gatherers worked were undertaken amongst the Zhuangzi in the 1960s by a Canadian anthropologist called Richard B. Lee. And he did a simple input-output analysis based on looking at how many hours people worked and what kind of nutrition they gathered from that. And he looked at the Zhuangzi, who were seen as a very good example of a traditional hunter-gatherer society. They were largely isolated in the northern Kalahari Desert. And more than that, they lived in an environment that was tough. It was a tough neighborhood. It was dry. It was harsh. You know, the Kalahari looks very bleak. It's the kind of place where somebody who doesn't have the knowledge imagines that starved to death very, very quickly indeed. And he was surprised to work out that in terms of the amount of time they spent securing and procuring food, they only needed about 15 hours per week per adult. And on the basis of that, and this is just sort of working age adults, you know, so the elderly would be looked after, children would be looked after as well. And on the basis of that, more than this, he discovered that they were actually better nourished than actually most Europeans and Americans were at the time that he undertook that study. And that kind of turned the whole world of our understanding of how hunter-gatherers operate and how well they lived completely on its head. You know, it seemed that these guys not only were better nourished than us, even though they looked like they lived in absolute terrible poverty, but they had considerably more leisure time than we did as well. Now, obviously, in an environment like that, people didn't think a great deal about work. Certainly, their attitude to work was not the same as ours. You know, we work for all sorts of future-focused goals and aspirations, achievements. We have dreams and all sorts of things that we think about all the time. For them, work was this kind of pragmatic response to immediate needs. So it wasn't considered as a sort of burden. You know, the way we think about work is very much shaped by the context in which we operate. Work is something we define ourselves by. It justifies our participation in a society. We see this narrative in politics all the time. You know, people talk about hardworking families, you know, this sense that somehow you deserve what you get, you know, even if it happens to be inherited, as often seems to be the case. But for them, they just didn't really see the world in terms of this division of work and non-work, and largely because they had to do so little of it, in certainly the sense that we did. And it was certainly not about shaping their participation in society. One didn't have to do this, I work, therefore I am. For people who couldn't work, they were invariably and inevitably looked after by the others that could. And so it wasn't a sense that they defined themselves by what they did. They defined themselves by the relationships that they had with one another and things like the egalitarianism and so on and the affection that they had for each other. But they didn't need to work to be. It wasn't I work, therefore I am.
What was the attitude toward material goods?
Well, interestingly, hunter-gatherer societies like that, you know, in a society which is as fiercely egalitarian as they are, there's actually very little point in accumulating material goods. There's a practical reason not to, because if you're a mobile hunter-gatherer and people lived within very clearly defined territories, which they owned, but the point is they needed to carry pretty much everything that they owned on their backs to move from one place to the next. So there wasn't a great need to accumulate material resources. And after all, what use was there for them anyway? People certainly made items of jewelry and beautiful things. But the value of making a beautiful item of jewelry was not so that you could keep it and show it off. It was so that you could get pleasure from giving it away. And the person you gave it away to would inevitably give it away to somebody else. So goods would sort of circle around and cycle around rather than sort of being stuck in one place so you could accumulate them. And it created, of course, a very different sort of set of relations between people. So it meant that people's relationships were not mediated by what they owned or the wealth that they had, but rather that the wealth or the objects that they used actually were operated in service to maintaining relationships and bonds of affection. And because this was such a highly anti-hierarchical society, because people objected to use this mechanism, the spontaneous mechanism of insulting people and tearing them down and mocking them the minute they got a bit braggarty or too big for their boots or show-offy. You know, I mean, if going back to Zhuangzi village after this radio interview, they'd be looking at me going like, oh, James, that was pretty rubbish. Don't get ahead of yourself and start thinking you're going to be on the radio every day. You know, it was pretty mediocre. But within that kind of space, there just wasn't the urge to accumulate resources because you couldn't turn unpractical resources, the fact that I own a lot of stuff or things that I'm not using immediately, you can't translate that into any kind of social power or gain. So people generally didn't have a great deal of stuff. What they did have was useful, But they also lived in a society where if they did have stuff, they were expected to share it. And if people wanted to share something, you know, there's an institution in many hunter-gatherer cultures called demand sharing. And these societies don't have the words please and thank you because it's not absolutely necessary. But generally, if I see something that you have that I want, I will be perfectly entitled to say, those are great headphones you're wearing. I'd like them, please. And you would generally be expected to give them to me. You'd say, oh, yes, that's okay. And then the next person might come along and ask me. And that way, goods carried a history of the people that owned them, but were less important than that. So they reflected effectively the relationships between people rather than the value of the goods themselves.
When the European settlers came to southern Africa, how did they affect the lives of the Bushmen?
It was devastating. I mean, it's a similar story that we've seen happening to many indigenous peoples everywhere, and in particular to hunter-gatherers. Really, because in much the same way that we as sort of Europeans conceptualized hunter-gatherers as living these nasty, brutish, and short struggles, there was a sense that somehow they were something inferior. And this is reflected wherever you go throughout history. The engagement between farmers and hunter-gatherers has often been very brutal. So when you had the first white colonials settling in southern Africa on the southern tip in the Cape and moving northwards into southern Africa, they tended to view Bushmen as vermin. They thought, ah, these are terribly undeveloped people. And they wanted, of course, the land. And so they treated them mercilessly. There were various genocidal acts and all sorts of things. And at the same time, you also had a migration of these African civilizations coming down through Central Africa and the North, sort of caught between these two agricultural civilizations converging on them. And they had very similar views. They too often enslaved Bushmen, treated them as vermin. And of course, as agricultural populations, because agricultural populations continue, they go through these sort of boom and bust cycles, rapid growth, and they need to expand. And they wanted the Kalahari. They wanted the lands Bushmen had. I mean, Bushmen existed much further than the Kalahari. They wanted any fertile land that they could take as they went on the sort of great growth of agriculture. And they took land that they could. And in places like the Kalahari, it was only when actually people developed the technologies to be able to drill water up from deep beneath the desert sands that the Bushmen were to eventually lose their land. And they have the population group, which were once undisputed masters of all of southern Africa, this vast area, nearly as big as the entire United States. 500 years ago, they were the almost exclusive owners of much of this land. Now, this population of 100,000 people are largely landless, hugely marginalized, desperately underrepresented, and pretty much at the base of every social development and access index that there is, and also subject to huge amounts of, I suppose, routine and day-to-day, good old-fashioned racial prejudice based on how they look, their culture, their language, and so on and so forth. So it's become a real struggle for them. It's like many minority struggles. But I suppose in their case, they've had to sort of navigate this extraordinary transition between being what we'd used to call a Stone Age culture to being part of this sort of modern, dynamic, and also very complicated nation state with all these colonial issues and liberation struggles thrown in on it. So it's a very tough time for them.
You are attuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM by mobile app and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is James Sussman, author of the book Affluence Without Abundance, The Disappearing World of the Bushmen. In your book, you contrast hunter-gatherers to farming communities. Overall, how have hunter-gatherers and farming communities viewed the world differently?
It's a very profound question. I think farming was a great accident, in a sense. Humankind hunted and gathered successfully for a really very, very long period of time. And farming only emerged about 12, 13,000 years ago, certainly in southern Europe, and then at various later dates in certain other geographies like China and West Africa as well. And I think that the shift to agriculture was partially enforced by a radical period of climate change. So you had the end of the last ice age about 12,000 years ago, which led to sort of very radical shift in the ecological composition, in particular of temperate areas like around the Mediterranean, a shift to these kind of grains, and it was a natural cycle. And so people's historical knowledge that they used for hunting and gathering, the plants they harvested and so on, suddenly became redundant, and they became dependent on a series of new plants, these sort of complex grains and olives and things like that. And farming started to happen accidentally, I think. As people became more dependent on fewer resources, they tended to look after those resources. And some species offer themselves up better to domestication than others. You know, so in terms of animal species, there were things like aurochs, which are ultimately the cattle that we know now. There were these sort of big European cattle lived in vast plains, and they were much larger and slightly wilder, but they were sort of amenable to domestication. Whereas you have other species, which very clearly aren't. You know, many of the African antelope are just not amenable to domestication. So you had these species that people began to focus on, and they eventually became agriculturalists. But agriculture demanded a very different way of thinking about the world. So when hunter-gatherers were focused on meeting their immediate needs, because hunter-gatherers sort of viewed the world as almost like a big supermarket. When you were hungry, there was always something there that you could go and harvest and do. And that's what we learned when Richard Lee did those studies of the Xinguasi. They had this extraordinary knowledge and the skills to actually carve a good living out of the environments that they lived in and do so with very limited effort. So it was sort of like being here. You know, if you run out of food in your house, you always know that actually there's a 7-Eleven down the road and I can just pop off and get there and sort something out. And that's how hunter-gatherers tended to view the world. When people became dependent on farming and one or two grains, first thing is a lot of the work that they did, so this is suddenly where work became future-oriented, a lot of the work they did was always going to yield rewards sometime in the future if circumstances were right. You plant seeds in the spring in the hope that you might get some food come the fall. You raise cattle in the hope that you might eventually turn them into a significant herd that produces enough milk to sustain you and meat to sustain you without you actually having to destroy the herd in the first place. So everything becomes future-oriented. You start building fences and so on so that you can manage your herd. You start setting up irrigation schemes, building complex irrigation projects so that you can provide enough water for your vegetables and crops in the future. So it creates this completely different shift in terms of how people think about time, how people think about themselves, and it brings with it a whole series of risks. Now, when you're a hunter-gatherer, if the rains are bad or you have a bad drought year, generally there are different species out of the 100 plant species or so that you use. Some respond better to good rains, some respond better to a dry season. So there's always something that sort of fits in with a shifting ecological niche. If you're a farmer or a plant grower, as you know, it can take one frost and it will wipe out your entire year's harvest. So the risks become huge. So people started to worry more and focus more on risk. And when you had a good harvest, you accumulated stuff. You had to sort of think in terms of things will go wrong. So it developed this sort of very risk-conscious and risk-averse mindset that we still very much have today. You know, you sit in a big business now and there's all these risk committees wanting to pre-plan and anticipate this, that, and the other. And so it creates this very forwarded risk-averse kind of thinking, which involves making hay. You know, we talk about making hay while the sun lasts. Hunter-gatherers would never be like that. If they're, you know, had a massive surplus of one kind of nut, they'd never eat more than they needed for that particular day, and they'd leave the rest to rot, which from an environmental point of view was always really good because it actually sustained future cycles and so on. Whereas with us, we'd accumulate it all, hang it, stick it in jars, pickle it, preserve it in the hope that it might serve us some good, or indeed that we might be able to trade with it and that way diminish risks for other things. So it completely changed the mindset that basically dominated Homo sapiens' evolutionary history. And created the mindset very much that we have today. I mean, I think a lot of the way we work and operate, even though I now actually think it's redundant, and we have to come up with new ways of living our lives, we still think very much like farmers. And a lot of our working culture, a lot of our social culture, a lot of our political culture is based on these very established ideas that were evolved when we're farmers. You have to work hard to get ahead, to beat the elements, and so on. And, you know, that would all be fine. But the problem is I think that our obsession with work at the moment risks cannibalizing our planet's future and our species' future. We produce endless stuff, which we often don't need. And again, that would all be very well if we weren't damaging things at the same time. And regardless of what official views are, things like we are all aware that the climate is changing one way or another, that there is some anthropogenic component to it, that the population is changing, that there's a massive extinction event happening that we're watching right now, you know, the sixth great extinction. And so it would all be fine if that wasn't happening. But I think now there's a very good case to be made to say that we need to try and understand how we can do things differently. And I think there's a lot of value by looking at Bushmen cultures who lasted so long, over 100,000 years, where we've only been doing this industrial stuff for 200 or 300 and we've nearly broken everything. Might there be some lessons that we can take from that that we can then apply to the process of reimagining how we might structure our future? how we might develop a more sustainable future in terms of how we engage with everything from technology to production to our working culture.
What are some of the specific lessons you would take from their culture?
I don't have any. It's funny. It's a question I keep getting asked quite often, and I don't think I'm clever enough to come up with any specific lessons. What I think is a good thing to do is take some sort of general principles and then use those for hopefully far cleverer people than me to actually come up with specific lessons. But general principles are one such as a very simple one. Try and operate within the dynamic constraints of your environment, because by doing that, one is unlikely to damage it, and you're unlikely to cannibalize your future as a result of it. Another critical one is to think, do not feel imprisoned by ideas that what we consider to be absolutely human nature. You know, there's the sense, that fatalist sense almost, that, oh, it's because our nature, we can't change it, therefore we better get on with it. So yeah, being mean, it's just human nature, people will say, you know, butch up, don't be such a snowflake, and so on. Actually, it's not necessarily human nature. I don't think we should let some idea of human nature bind our thinking. History tells us that there are many different ways of having lived, and that people have found greater satisfaction and success, and that our species has thrived as a result of thinking in very different ways to the way that we tend to think is our destiny now. And I think, if anything, that's really the key lesson, is that if we're looking towards, I suppose, modern challenges, let's not feel constrained in terms of how we try and imagine our future. So when we look at things like automation and the risks around robot, at the moment, people think, oh God, they're taking our jobs. What are they going to do? You know, whereas 30 years ago, we were all imagining lives of jets and like convenience. But now the great panic is, oh, we're losing workers. People are going to become unemployed. How are we going to make them work? Maybe the question is we should look at automation and say, well, what sort of opportunity does this provide us to reimagine our relationship with the workplace? Maybe the answer is that we start working a 15-hour week, because it's clear that we can meet our basic productive needs on the strength of that, and then we can spend our time doing other things. It doesn't mean not having work, you know, and I think in particular in sort of highly driven countries like the United States and England to a large degree, and places like Australia as well, these Anglophone countries, there's a real conflation between work and employment and labor and purposiveness. Humans are, I think, very purposive people. We like to create and do stuff and strive. But we don't necessarily need to do that in terms of the sort of broad productive machine that we are. People strive and strive in terms of writing books or creating poetry or religious practice or physical practice, you know, from dance to being great at kung fu. You know, changing the way we think about work, and with it, I suppose, the broader economic institutions and system based on these old agricultural revolutionary ideas. Actually, you know, there's all sorts of opportunities available to us. And things like automation might well provide the spur to rethinking that entire aspect of our life. And hopefully in doing so, establish a more sustainable future for ourselves and our species.
Well, thanks so much for being here.
My pleasure.
You are just listening to James Sussman, author of the book Affluence Without Abundance, The Disappearing World of the Bushman, published in 2017 by Bloomsbury. For more information, check on the web at FromTheBush.com. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on Listener Powered 90.3 FM by mobile app and at KEXP.org.